The Sleep Insight series invites listeners to learn about this amazing adventure we take every night called sleep. Through these insightful discussions, we examine sleep and our society's beliefs about sleep from a variety of angles. We hope you'll learn some cool new facts and analogies that you can use to help us raise awareness about this underappreciated one-third of our lives. Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen, so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness.
Thank you all so much for coming today. My name is Lindsay Scola, and when I was 16, I went to see my general practitioner after I had been experiencing some really bad sleepiness during the day. And she looked at me and said, "You're busy, and busy people are tired." And that rang in my ears as I went through college and as I arrived on the Hill myself. And then I was surrounded by these incredible, smart, talented people who seemed to be just as tired as I thought I was. But I thought people just wanted it more than I did. I thought that they were just a little more talented than I was. I thought they were a little more dedicated than I was. And I had no idea that 13 years later, I'd be diagnosed with narcolepsy. When we talk about the macro importance of bringing sleep education and sleep disorder education to people across the country, and the importance of getting more people diagnosed, and the importance of getting more information into people's hands, I want you to remember the micro importance for the people that are sitting in this room, for yourselves, for your colleagues, that sometimes your tired can be different. And if you are experiencing a place where you're feeling like you might not want it as much as the person next to you, or that you just can't keep up a little bit, and that your wakefulness just really isn't what you thought it should be, remember that there are sleep disorders out there. And hopefully that this information today will be just as important for you as I wish it had been for me 19 years ago in this space. So it is my great honor to introduce our next speaker to you. Dr. Michael Granier is one of my favorite sleep doctors. He is a licensed clinical psychologist, director of sleep and health research program at the University of Arizona, and the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Clinic at Banner University Medical Center in Tucson, Arizona. And he has consulted for things like Google, Major League Baseball, the Olympics, that you might have heard of, and a few more like that. And also one of the most incredibly dynamic and exciting speakers I've ever heard on sleep. So with no further ado, Dr. Granier.
Thank you, Lindsay. So I was supposed to, in 15 minutes-ish or less, summarize everything about why sleep is important and how it impacts everything. I don't know how I'm going to pull that off, but I'm going to try. And I want to start at the beginning. And what I mean by that is, what is sleep and why is it important? And I think it's important to begin with the idea that sleep is a biological requirement for human life. We don't sleep because we enjoy it. We don't sleep because it's good for you. We sleep because it's a requirement and we don't have any other choice. That's why every human has slept since the first, pretty much every day. And when you think about it that way, what are the other biological requirements for life? What do we need to live? We need to breathe air, right? We need to drink water. We need to eat food. You can make an argument for find shelter, and that's pretty much it. Like, so sleep is in that community, but no one says things like, you know, when I retire, I'm going to drink clear water. I'll drink brown water for now because, like, I'm busy and I've got stuff to do, but, like, you know, maybe by the time I retire, I'll drink clean water. Or, like, You know, breathing unpolluted air, like that's just a luxury for lazy people with too much free time on their hands. Like, who wants to breathe clean air? Like, who's got time for that? But we say that about sleep. And I think that that's the problem here. So what is sleep? Sleep isn't just a biological process. It's a non-negotiable, universal biological need that parallels our need for air, food, and water. And yet we live in a society that sees sleep as an unproductive use of time. And there is nothing more un-American than an unproductive use of time. And that's where the problem is, right? It's this dissonance between what our bodies kind of want and need to function and what the world around us pressures us to do. We don't have social pressure. You know, we have some social pressures for breathing unhealthy air, like if we're working in an inner factory or something. But by and large, societally, you know, we have these pressures to sleeping less. We're starting to wrap our head around the fact that there might be consequences here. Sleep health is a major public health issue. Using CDC data, we were able to map out counties in the U.S. that were hot spots and cold spots of insufficient sleep in the U.S. And what you can see is it aggregates. There's a lot of white, and those are data that the CDC didn't have. We were able to get estimates for a lot of the counties, but not all of them. There's still a lot to do, but what you can see is it's distributed in certain areas. So it's not just random. There's social and environmental things going on. About a third of U.S. adults aren't getting sufficient sleep, and with consequences for mental and physical health and performance. Sleep health is a known factor in the leading causes of death in the U.S. Sleep health is a predictor of heart disease, cancer, infectious diseases, lung diseases, Alzheimer's, mental health problems, diabetes. All of these are causally related to sleep. And there's about estimated 50 to 70 million Americans with sleep or circadian conditions that are diagnosable, and most are completely unaddressed. And this is a need. So the majority of sleep disorders remain undiagnosed and untreated. The most common likely sleep disorder is insomnia disorder. We have very little data on that nationally, surprisingly. But what we do have some data on are some of the other key sleep disorders like narcolepsy and sleep apnea, where the most current estimates that I've seen are about 75 to 85% of cases that are out there have not yet been diagnosed. This causes a huge public health problem. Sleep disorders often go undiagnosed for years and sometimes even decades before people are able to receive the correct treatment, usually by a board-certified sleep specialist of some kind. Those are usually the people. The average medical school in 4 years has an average of about 1 hour on all of sleep. That's it. And so a lot of practitioners and clinicians don't have the training they need to be able to spot these things. And this is why we rely on sleep professionals. Yeah, the average delay to diagnosis, what I was able to find for narcolepsy was between 8 and 15 years was the average. And for sleep apnea, 10 plus years is the average. In my clinic, I see this all the time. Even in people with insomnia, people have been misdiagnosed as depression or anxiety and treated for these things for years. And then they still have these sleep problems, whether it's insomnia, sleep apnea, hypersomnia disorders like narcolepsy. These are undiagnosed, untreated, and our population is bearing the burden of that. So the take-home message, the majority of Americans, most Americans who have sleep disorders either don't know, or even if they know, they're not diagnosed and they're not treated. And we have to deal with the consequences of that. Some of those consequences are economic. The recent estimates were that the U.S. loses about 1% of its total GDP per year due to insufficient sleep alone. That's a lot of money. So there was a study that I did back a few years ago. We went into a very large employer, which I can tell you is actually a state. We went into a state employment system. So these are all state employees. Found that the ones with the worst sleep trouble, who had frequent sleep problems, across the board, they were costing $5,000 to $8,000 per person per year more just in overall healthcare spending. And it got worse as their sleep problem got worse. And this is in addition to productivity loss, absenteeism, presenteeism, et cetera. And then this is other data from a different large employer showing that a sleep disorders treatment program. So that they were going through their self-insured employer. They're looking at their records and they found who got diagnosed, and of the ones who got a diagnosis, who actually got the treatment. And of the ones who got the treatment, even just getting diagnosed to getting treated, saved them about $2,400 per person per year in just additional healthcare spending. It didn't cost them more to get them treated. Year one, it ended up costing them a little more. But by year three, they were saving $2,400 per person per year just by getting the sleep disorder diagnosed and treated. So sleep is related to a whole wide range of health outcomes, whether it's cardiovascular, metabolic, immune health, mental health, behavioral health, and cognitive health. The easy and tough thing about sleep is pick something in your life that you care about. What is something that you want to be able to accomplish? What is a skill you want to have? What is something in your health that matters to you? Something in a family member that's holding them back or that they're at risk for? I could probably find the data that shows that sleep is related because sleep is so foundational. Sleep is, again, it's a foundational part of our biology. It's been there since before the beginning. Scientists are studying sleep. Most of the advances in human sleep genetics come from studying fruit flies because their sleep system is so well preserved all the way up the evolutionary chain. Like, these are old systems that are embedded all throughout our biology. So it's pick an outcome you care about. Sleep is probably related to it somehow. And so that's why, so one thing I'm super excited about, the American Heart Association, one of the largest nonprofits in the U.S., and especially around health, they, about 10 years ago, they switched their perspective from cardiovascular disease only to also cardiovascular health, because the idea was cardiovascular disease only might be too late. How do you prevent this? So they came up with this metric called Life Simple 7, and it was the seven metrics of heart health and overall health. It was blood pressure, let's see if I can remember them off the top of my head. Blood pressure, lipids, fasting, glucose, weight, diet, physical activity, and smoking. Those were the simple seven. And how many of these seven did you have in your favor, and how many of them were working against you in terms of your health? And so they had this for about 10 years, and it was super helpful in terms of predicting population health outcomes. But there was something missing in the simple seven. And actually, as of about a year or two ago, it is now rebranded as Life's Essential 8. It is no longer just the simple seven. It has the same seven, and now you can see sleep is now added to the list. Sleep now has, according to the American Heart Association, sleep has equal billing now with some of these other measures because they've recognized its importance. They formed a sleep committee. I'm the inaugural chair of their sleep committee. We're coming out with position statements on sleep. They're changing all their social media and education. They're changing a lot of their stuff. Because their American Heart has recognized sleep as foundational. American Diabetes is coming next. They've been working on this as well. The Alzheimer's Association is working on this as well. I mean, beta amyloid and tau build up in the brain, highly sleep dependent. And we're learning all the science of this. So it's an important part of overall health. Here's some CDC data from about 400,000 US adults showing that the people who get about 7 to 8 hours of sleep are the least likely to have chronic health conditions like obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. But it's not just a correlation. If you take people who don't have those things and you follow them for a certain number of years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, depending on the study, what you see is the ones with worse sleep health are the ones more likely to develop them. So people who don't get adequate sleep are more than 50% more likely to become obese than they were before. They're more than 20% more likely to develop high blood pressure. They're more than 30% more likely to become diabetic, controlling for whatever they could control for in the model with sleep, the amount of sleep they got at time one being what sets them on a different trajectory. And this is even old data. I mean, these meta-analyses are over 10 years old now. We've known, this is one of the reasons the American Heart Association has been turning around. It's so clear. I wanted to point out that weight management is especially sensitive to sleep, where people who don't sleep well are more likely to gain weight, have trouble losing weight, and having trouble keeping weight off over time. And other aspects of health that we find important too. Pretty much every hormone system is connected to sleep somehow because sleep serves so many regulatory. And a lot of hormones serve regulatory functions. I mean, you can see all over the body, see this. And in the immune system. It's not a coincidence that most people know to rest and maybe get extra sleep when you're sick. The immune system and sleep are very closely tied together. It can predict whether or not you catch colds, viruses, flus, and whether medications work better, vaccines work better, how quickly are you going to recover, all of these things. Also, brain health. Sleep loss impairs your brain's ability to function, process emotions. This is why sleep and mental health are so closely connected, but other aspects of brain health too. Sleep deprivation increases stress and stress reactivity and all of these things. Sleep disturbances are in nearly every mental health issue. And we have a mental health crisis in our country, and sleep is a big part of what's going on. A lot of people don't realize that sleep, poor sleep health, insomnia, and other sleep disorders triple suicide risk. They're one of the most reliable increased risk factors for suicide, independent of depressed mood. And changes in sleep actually predict changes in suicide ideation better than changes in depression. It's very closely related. And so this is also a major public health issue. And also in terms of brain health, I mentioned a little bit about Alzheimer's, but anyone who hasn't had good sleep knows it impacts your brain function. What a lot of people don't realize is the impact on your brain function, your ability to think, is cumulative over time. It recovers with sleep recovery, but the longer you go not sleeping well, the less able to tell how impaired you are. So often you get worse and worse and worse, and you think you're adjusting. All the data show that the longer you go not getting adequate sleep, you're not adjusting. You're having to compensate, but your body just doesn't adjust to it. So the last thing I wanted to talk about before a word about some policy ideas from a researcher, not a policy person, is this concept that sleep is contextual. Sleep isn't something that just happens inside the cell membrane. It's something that happens in context. So you have the sleeping person here that's related to these health outcomes I was talking about. But if we're going to improve sleep at the population level, we have to understand what we're improving and where we have to intervene. And at the first level, we have these individual level factors. These are the things like your own thoughts, feelings, behaviors, your genetics, your choices, your health. These are the things that make you decide when to put your screen down and all of this stuff. Or it could be what disorder you're carrying, is it treated or untreated, things inside of you. But that's often just the start of the conversation, because we have to recognize that these individual factors are embedded in a social level, things that exist outside of you. Like, I mean, how many people in this room can say not one night of sleep in the last week had anything to do with work, you know, had anything, and that exists outside of you, anything to do with family, anything to do with your social networks, anything to do with where you live, any of these things, your family, culture, religion, socioeconomics, these exist outside of you, but they create the environment within which you operate. And then even that exists within a societal level, where things like that exist even inside of, like technology. Like, how many people sleep within arm's reach of one of these things? And that's society. It was not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence that people made different choices. It's not a coincidence that everyone's job and work and family and social networks changed how they communicate. Society changed. And this is sometimes where issues of policy come in terms of drowsy driving. I mean, the data show that drowsy driving is one of the major risk factors on the highway, and we're working on this, and there's so many opportunities. So for example, making sure that we promote, just, we're still at awareness. Like, everyone knows sleep exists, but I think a lot of people haven't wrapped their heads around how much it's impacting their actual life, and that it's fixable and solvable, and there's solutions out there. We need community-based approaches. We need to educate health providers. They're the ones on the front lines, and they don't know what they're looking at. They don't have the training. We need to better understand and address population sleep health, which is why funding for things like NIH and CDC are absolutely critical. And then there's some low-hanging fruit of stuff that the scientific community knows, things like school start times and daylight savings and some of these issues that could be addressed. But anyway, talked a little too much already. Thank you so much. If you have any questions, I'm easy to find, and reach out to Project Sleep. So thank you.
Are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
It's now my honor to introduce Dr. Callie Cyrus. She's a psychiatrist, assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Johns Hopkins University, a contributor to national news programs like CNN, NPR, and others, as well as featured on Showtime's hit show, Couples Therapy. Dr. Callie Cyrus.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you guys about how I got diagnosed, because I think there we have our assumptions about what someone with narcolepsy is supposed to look like and what their day is like. But I'll just, so I'm 40 right now, and I was diagnosed at 31. I'll tell you a little bit about how I got to that point so you can just kind of understand what it's like. So I'll call the first phase sleepy. I mean, in high school, growing up, I fell asleep in class, but so did other high schoolers. I mean, we were up until, I don't know, 2 a.m. doing homework and then playing sports and then all of these other things. I don't see how any high schooler is actually just awake in general. So I didn't really think much of it. And I went to college and I was up really late, able to stay up really late doing things that college students do, and would fall asleep in biology class because it was boring. And then I got to medical school and started to get a little sleepier, but again, thought it was just normal for someone who was studying 10 to 12 hours a day. But I realized that my classmates could stay awake in lecture. That was required. And I would be asleep within 15 minutes and miss the rest of the lecture. Or when I would study at coffee shops with my friend and we'd go from 7 to 7, I would have to take a nap at the coffee shop table during lunchtime. He didn't have to do that. And then, you know, I got to my surgery rotation and I would fall asleep standing against the wall in the operating room while everyone is around the body. And I am just like hiding somewhere in the background trying to get some sleep. And during this whole time, you know, I just thought it was, oh, Callie's sleepy. These are funny stories to tell people. And then I think like a lot of things that sort of catch up to you, it did. So I started residency, which is, you know, once you've gotten your medical degree, now you're in your training for your specialty. And I'm a psychiatrist. We spent our first year of psychiatry working on internal medicine, which means I'm working with the kidney doctors, the liver doctors. I'm doing all of these things that are so intense, not really my jam, but forced to do it. And people are very serious in medicine. I mean, I'd like to think I'm not, but we're extremely serious. So for me to be falling asleep at lunchtime conferences was really, really bad. It was incredibly embarrassing. And I had no idea why I was just so sleepy. I was going to bed at 8 p.m., waking up at 5:30 a.m., and still could barely keep my eyes open once I had to sit down. So, you know, a few years go by of this while I'm in residency, continues to get worse. I start getting written up on my reports that Callie's falling asleep in class. She's disinterested. I remember at one point having like in a 3-person meeting, literally not being able to keep my eyes open, sitting in front of like a supervising doctor nodding off, or the worst when your eyes are, you don't know they're fully open. Do you guys know that you're like trying to keep them open to try to like fake the fact that you're awake, but you're not really awake and just missing time? I was starting to fall asleep on my patients. You know, I had a long distance girlfriend at the time. So whenever we got into a fight, she knew not to bring anything up past 8 p.m. because I would literally fall asleep on the phone in the middle of the conversation. And it just continued in that way until I couldn't function. I couldn't keep things together. I was missing meetings. I was forgetting really important things. I misplaced everything, which sounds a little bit like ADHD. So I was just assuming maybe this is finally the time to get treated for ADHD. And my psychiatrist at the time said to me, maybe you should get a sleep study. And honestly, I'll tell you, as a psychiatrist, I used to just think sleep studies were kind of BS. Like, yeah, you should get a sleep study. But unless you have sleep apnea and you're snoring, then why would we even really need to do this thing? So I did it begrudgingly, and she started me on meds for ADHD because I needed them, and it probably took about 8 months before I even got to the sleep study. So that's one policy thing, is I don't know what the funding is like for sleep specialists, but every sleep test center is ridiculously backed up. So, you know, I'm just trying to stay awake, taking these stimulants like I would for ADHD, and I finally get to my sleep study. And let me tell you a little bit about it. It's extremely painful. So you have to go to this like hotel kind of looking place, but you stay overnight and you have your own little room with the bed and the TV. And then the first night you get there, they hook all the, you know, things to your head and they watch you overnight. And usually the next morning, if you're there for sleep apnea, they've already, you know, gotten the data on what they need. How quickly did you fall asleep? Did your brain get enough oxygen? But then the next part of the day is the narcolepsy test. So they wake you up at like 6 o'clock in the morning, and then they force you to stay awake for 2-hour periods. And you cannot sit down or lay on the bed. And if there's like a camera and a like a sound, like a speaker, and someone's watching you like a Big Brother kind of God type. So you're literally trying to stay up. I'm like watching television, standing on my feet. And the moment I would, you know, put my arm on something and my eyes would close, you'd hear a voice that says, Callie, Callie, stay awake. We need you to stay awake. And then after 2 hours, they force you to take a 20-minute nap, which is like good and bad because you desperately need to nap. But then they're going to wake you up after like minutes. You want to sleep a little bit longer. But what they're doing is when they force you to take this nap, they're looking for how quickly you fall asleep. And then when you do fall asleep, do you dream? And you do this 4 times throughout the day. So needless to say, by cycle number 3, the doctor called me back and he said, you can go home. We know you got it. But it wasn't actually that clear. So I'll tell you a little bit more about it. So when you do a sleep test like that, again, you want to measure how quickly you fall asleep. So sleep latency. I fell asleep within 2 minutes for every single nap. Unfortunately, when you're starting to measure dreams, I'm also on an antidepressant for anxiety and depression. And the thinking is that when you're on something like that, your dreams may not show up in the testing. And so I go in and my sleep study, this doctor's like an expert, but he essentially said, even though we don't see you having dreams in these phases, we know, like, did you dream? And I said, yes, of course, I remember dreaming. He said, you probably have it. But because of that, my diagnosis was not officially narcolepsy. It's idiopathic hypersomnia. And you guys know, I don't know if you have chronic illnesses or maybe you have anxiety or depression, but people, you know, when you say, oh, I'm really sleepy, or oh, I'm feeling really sad. Well, I feel really sad, or I feel really sleepy. So having a diagnosis kind of makes you feel more legitimate in what you're going through. So, you know, it's a little bit of an ego thing not to fully know what it's called. And so that's essentially what it's been like since I had the sleep study, which I'm not going to go through anytime soon again. But that's sort of the way I've been thinking about what my condition is. I think since I got diagnosed, I was able to get accommodation. So I was able to get a bigger office and get a couch so I could take my naps. People knew why I was falling asleep. But I think as the years progressed, I really started to understand a little bit more about what these symptoms actually meant in terms of how they impacted my life, because you can't get accommodations everywhere. Maybe like in the medical world, we tend to be a little bit more flexible with that. So I actually worked on the Hill. So after leaving my residency and training as a psychiatrist, I came and worked with Senator Chris Murphy for a year. I don't envy what you guys do at all. I don't know how you sit there from 9 to 6. Do you guys know how serious it is? And I was seeing a doctor at this point. My psychiatrist was, I don't know, 40 minutes on the train. So I'd wake up at 5, get to her by 7, then need to be at the Hill. I would fall asleep on the train there and back, needing to set an alarm. I don't know if you've ever been on a train and then you look like an able-bodied person, but you are standing there knowing you will fall asleep. So I had to sit in the chair that is designated for folks with disabilities and then wondering if people are going to judge me for sitting in this chair. And then I would get to the office, sitting with these 2 televisions and a computer, falling asleep the entire time, trying to stand up and go walk around the building, or then go to a hearing that sitting right behind Elizabeth Warren and then C-SPAN is taping you and you're like desperately just trying to keep your eyes open. So embarrassing. And so I've realized at this stage, I have to design my work in a way that accommodates me taking a daytime nap, which is essentially what I do. So as a doctor, as a psychiatrist, I make my money by seeing patients, which is sitting down for 45 to 50 minutes, giving medications, like really listening deeply, which is pretty difficult to do when you're sleepy. And I have to plan that nap in. My entire life is impacted by this. What time I have to go to sleep, what time I wake up in the morning, what I do during the day, if I'm going to go out with my friends and my family. I don't start my day until noon because I need time to wake up, do a bunch of things, and take a nap before I actually start seeing clients. And it's not just the sleepiness. You know, when you fall asleep, I've seen people standing at the door in my bedroom while I'm asleep. It feels so real. And that's another part of this condition. You have these real hypnagogic hallucinations and you're sitting there and you cannot move because you also have sleep paralysis. So imagine seeing people in your room that you can't move or do anything about. I can't even watch like Game of Thrones or House of Dragons before bed because I will be dreaming about the dragons. They are in my life. I am like actually trying to do something with them. and my partner is here, I will sometimes have conversations with her and wake up and ask, did we talk about this thing? And she's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And this is just part of life. Sometimes I just wake up in the middle of the night and I'm up for a couple hours because I can't go to sleep, or I'm just dreaming the entire time and I have to force myself to wake up so I can actually get out of that distressing dream. And so I think at this age and stage, you know, it's, again, we're all sleepy, but you never know how sleepy people actually are and why. And so if that's you, and I've had a lot of clients like this who've gone to get sleep studies, which I now recommend to everyone, to really get it checked out. Because when you hear stats like this around Alzheimer's and dementia, you start to realize what kind of risk this actually is for the future as you age when you don't get restful sleep, which we all need. Thank you.
Now I would like to introduce Julie Flagar, who is the award-winning author of Wide Awake and Dreaming. She has been featured by Marie Claire Magazine, ABC News, NBC News, among many others. And she is the founder and president and CEO of Project Sleep, the incredible organization, and the reason that we are all here today. Julie.
Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Why am I here today? I run Project Sleep. We're a small 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness about sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. And the story behind that is I was in law school, and I was at Boston College Law. Woo-hoo, go Eagles. And I really thought maybe I just wasn't meant for law school. I was having a lot of trouble getting through the coursework, but well, the cases are kind of boring, you know, kind of like med school. So I just thought I just didn't have the willpower. Something had shifted in my life. And eventually did find out that I had type 1 narcolepsy with cataplexy. And I was really struck by this because I had organized my daytime life so carefully to succeed in life. You know, like you plan your day from 7 a.m. until midnight or whatever so carefully. But what I didn't think to curate, or I couldn't curate, or I couldn't even control, was what was happening at nighttime. That my brain wasn't going into the right forms of sleep at night. Not only did I not realize that, it's just really not something I could control personally. So I ended up moving to Washington, D.C. after I graduated from law school and started going to any meetings. This is like my first briefing I attended and stood at the back of the room. And now it's pretty exciting to actually be leading an event like this. I also published a book about my story because I'd seen movies like Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, Rat Race, stuff like that, right? I thought, I don't have narcolepsy because I didn't associate with that term, like falling asleep in the middle of a sentence. So really started to share my own story through a memoir. And, you know, I think what was striking too in law school especially is that not only do we not take something like narcolepsy seriously, we didn't really take sleep seriously. We were still bragging about playing all-nighters. And I remember we had a 24-hour exam. I don't know what that means. Like, do you stay up for the whole 24 hours to like take the exam the whole time? Do you sleep? It was unclear. So as I learned more about sleep after I was diagnosed with a sleep disorder, I started to find out it was really pretty fascinating. And we've already, Dr. Granier has spoken a lot about this, but I love this quote from Why We Sleep. We no longer have to ask what sleep is good for. Instead, we are now forced to wonder whether there is any biological function that does not benefit from a good night's sleep. So far, the results of thousands of studies insist that no, there aren't. So what is Project Sleep doing to try to make change? We really believe in storytelling. So I've, you know, obviously shared my story through my book, but now we've trained over 160 speakers in 18 countries around the world to tell their stories of living with different sleep disorders. So we have an amazing group of advocates that are out there raising awareness. Many of them maybe live in your congressional districts and have contacted you to invite you here today. We have a wonderful expert advisory board. Dr. Cyrus and Dr. Granier are both members of our expert advisory board, which includes patients, researchers, and clinicians together. Who help advise us. And really just wanted to point out a new resource that we've recently launched called the Sleep Helpline, which is a free national helpline for any questions that you have about sleep issues or sleep disorders. This is just the place to call. There are so many points in my journey where I just wasn't really sure what the next step is, you know? And I really wish something like this had existed when I first started to realize that maybe something was wrong with my sleep. I wish I would have been able to call something like this. So we're super proud to have this resource available. This is something that you can share. Lindsay had a term for it in a congressional, what was it, newsletter? A great thing to let people know about. So obviously we have a great advocacy program. Every year Project Sleep hosts a sleep advocacy forum in the fall. And that's to really bring the different sleep organizations together. Some of them are here today. It's a terrific group of professional societies, research societies, and patient groups. And we do lead an annual appropriations letter every year. So we're really excited. A next step for us that we really want to talk to you about and why we hope to get your help is the Sleep Act, Sleep Leading to Enhance Epidemiology and Public Health. Dr. Granger helped us put terms into a great acronym. Yes, so thanks to Dr. Granger for that. What the bill would do would be to help create a sleep program at the CDC. We're really excited because there's great research that comes out of NIH. NIH has really well-funded sleep research. So all these great facts that Dr. Granger can talk to you about the importance of sleep, those are out there. Even something like narcolepsy, in 1999, they discovered, you know, pretty much the cause of narcolepsy. Now that's actually led to newer treatment options that are being developed. But unless people actually know that they have a sleep disorder, they can't actually access those treatments. So that's why we think it's really important to raise awareness and through the CDC. So this new act would help to create a program at the CDC to enhance public health activities and also more of the collecting and maintaining data so that we can better track sleep across the country. There's also a part of the bill that speaks to HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, to increase clinician knowledge. As Dr. Granger said, often in med school, it's 1 hour for all of sleep. So we sleep a third of our lives, but it's 1 hour in the curriculum. So we'd be really excited to have more with HRSA to help educate clinicians about sleep and sleep disorders. So Dr. Caleb Gilchrist is at the at Danny Davis's office, and he's helping us lead the charge. If you're interested, and your office might be interested in getting involved, we hope to introduce the bill this fall. So we're excited to gain momentum and help solve like a really big issue that, you know, we can have the greatest research come out, we can have great treatments come out, but unless people know about it, they can't access it.
The Project Sleep Podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.